And now our speaker. Please help me welcome Dave T., home group of South College Speakers Group.
Hi, everybody. My name's Dave Phillips. I'm an alcoholic.
I guess the only light in the house. That's real good. My sobriety date is July 22nd of 2001, and my home group is the South College Avenue Speaker Group. Some of you have been there. It meets on Wednesday nights. It's just like this. We read a little bit, ask for announcements, and then the speaker speaks for the entire hour. And as a result of having this sponsor, who took me through the exact directions, not some of the directions, but the exact directions out of the big book, out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I recovered from alcoholism. And a wholesale miracle happened in my life, you know. This is not my first time in AA. You know, this is my fourth time in AA. And I'm sorry to bore some of the crowd that are here because they got to hear me Saturday night, so I don't know if God will let me come up with anything new. I have a pretty much a 38-year drunkalogue, so there's plenty of stuff that God can choose from the podium. Some of it's funny, some of it's tragic. It wasn't funny going through most of it when it was happening, although it may have seemed like that, but in an inebriated state, everything seems kind of fun until you get the charge sheet the next day. My sponsor stood at the podium once. He said, "You might be alcoholic if when you come to the next day, you don't know what you've been charged with until they have the rap sheet come around." And that definitely fits my experience. I remember my very first drink of alcohol. It was when I was 5 years old, and I had a very abnormal reaction to it. You know, long and short of it, when I took and drank it, I could taste the alcohol in the background, and it was nasty. And I swallowed it out of fear. You know, I've only done that twice. To me, that's social drinking. I'm married to a non-alcoholic wife, and she knows how to abuse alcohol. If you don't know what that's like, if you've ever been out with a non-alcoholic, a non-drinker, alcohol abuse, I like to refer to it as that way, is they'll order a drink in the meal. They'll be lucky if they drink half of it during the meal, and it's a $5 drink. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when I sit across from those people, what goes in my mind, and it finally went away a few years ago, but what would go in my mind, aren't you going to finish that? You know, and like order the next one. For some reason, alcohol does not affect my wife like it affects me. You know, when my sponsor had me read the doctor's opinion where it says, if you're alcoholic, we like the effect produced by alcohol. Duh, you know, it's one of my favorite things. You know, I started paying prices for alcohol use and abuse very early on. I was asked to leave high school. I was asked to leave every program that I was offered to better my life, you know, whether it be church or school or organization. And I can't say, in all honesty, that I haven't been given opportunities that some people to this day aren't given to better themselves. But it seemed like when I was given those opportunities, when it came down to choosing between alcohol and everything that went along with it, or that, alcohol always seemed to win out. And I don't know why that is. It's just that something in that keen alcoholic mind, and by the way, you'll only hear that in AA. You know, Al-Anon, they call it something else, and I won't repeat it from the podium. You know, but only alcoholics had that, you know, where it's, you know, I heard it best. One of the youngest-looking old people in AA down in Baltimore, and it really does. This guy's extremely old, and you can't tell it. He said it best. He said it at one day, it just seemed like he sold his simple human dignity for the price of a drink. And he doesn't know when that happened. And that's my experience. I don't know when I crossed, if there's a magical line across where I just walked across it and there was no going back. I may be able to see what that was like. But I crossed something that I was never able to get back. And I don't know when I did it. I think I crossed it like in my early teens. I understand this is AA, but drugs are a part of my story. So if this offends anybody, take it up with your sponsor. I don't really care, you know. But I stuck a needle in my arm when I was 15 years old in the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Philadelphia. I was at an award ceremony, and I was one of the honorees at 15 for something I had done for a program I was in. And I pursued that to the gates of insanity and death from the time I was 15. You know, and I tried to get, you know, my friends that were into just doing the leafy green substance and maybe snorting occasionally, because this was the funnest thing I've ever experienced in my life. It was like, I'm a licensed skydiver, and it was like finding skydiving or base jumping for the first time. And it just, I went with it. And by the time I was 17, some things were going to happen that were going to change my whole outlook and attitude upon life, especially when it concerned alcohol. My father died when I was 17, and I was devastated. I'd never experienced death up to that point. And I had a Vietnam friend of mine named Charlie, and he came and knew exactly what would take away the sting of death. And he got the biggest bottle of vodka he could find at the liquor store and mixed it with grapefruit juice. And, you know, I'm not too sure what vodka tastes like at the time, but I knew grapefruit was nasty. But when you add those two together, guess what? Vodka and grapefruit juice is palatable, you know. And I was able to drink enough to make death oblivious. And I don't know about anybody else, but at 17 years old, when the sting of death becomes non-painful and you become oblivious to it, that did something in me that nothing else had ever done before. Alcohol took away death. And to me, that was like it was the answer of all answers. That meant no matter how bad my life ever got, alcohol was always going to be my solution. And that's what happened. I was unemployed and unemployable, and I was basically self-employed at 17 years of age, meaning to afford, all those other things, I stole for a living, and the military back then in 1979, 1980 would take anybody, and they took me. No high school diploma, couldn't have passed a drug test, but they didn't give us drug tests in 1979, 1980, and I took did a physical, did some blood work, I went up to go get my airborne stamp because they were going to stage. They asked me if I wanted to jump out of airplanes, and that sounded pretty good. And I went up to get an airborne stamp and came down and said, "Oh, the position's been filled, but we got something else that we think you really like." And it was like, "How'd you like to live in Hawaii for 3 years?" I don't know about anybody else, but I remember Hawaii from the Brady Bunch, and I was like, "Yeah, beaches and all that stuff." So off I go. The military was a very, very interesting time. I did get an honorable discharge after 3 years. My drinking took off. At 17 through 20, I was able to drink legally, and I don't know about anybody else, but that fit me so well. I learned that you could drink till 4 o'clock in the morning in Waikiki, make it back to post before 6, and then go run 3 miles. And I learned how to run drunk. You didn't want to fall out, because when you did, you had to do the same thing again at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and by that time it was so ungodly hot, your hangover was immense. Don't fall out. So if you puke, get back in the formation and keep running. And I just loved it, and of course they call it now alcohol poisoning. That was just one of the prices you had to pay. I remember one time that my roommate, he actually saved my life. I had passed out and started vomiting on my back, and he yanked me off the mattress, put me back on the bed, turned me over so I would vomit. And they had little pull-out drawers for your socks and your T-shirts, all nice and neatly folded. Well, what was on top of them? It was like The Exorcist. There was vomit all over the room and stuff. And our squad leader had recently transferred from the 82nd Airborne, and he's a Ranger. And he didn't take kindly to us not showing up in formation. Kicked our door open, and I learned how to do this force PT. Like 20 minutes later, I learned how to do a lot of push-ups while puking and not stop. And I did not have a say in that. It was forced to do it, or it would even be worse. I got in trouble in every single country I went to as a direct result of alcohol. And I say that with some clarity. The one country two countries that we went to that I didn't get in trouble in was the American Samoas and Japan. America and Samoas and Japan, they never let us off the freaking plane. But New Zealand, same thing. Korea, the same thing. Like I told the people on Saturday, is there anybody in the room that can turn down free booze when you're out there drinking? It's like it's like a crackhead turning down free rock. Not going to happen. And we had a New Zealand sergeant major that was taking a group of us illegally off the post day after day to get drunk. New Zealand loves the United States military, apparently what we did for them in Vietnam, and I think it should have been the other way around. But if you're an American serviceman in New Zealand and you go to their NCO clubs, you do not have to buy any drinks. I don't know about anybody else, but that appealed to me. We got caught doing that. We were warned not to do it anymore. They said, "What? We'll make you a deal if you don't do it anymore, and you just follow the rules. We'll let bygones be bygones." My company commander told me that. My first sergeant told me that. But that night, the guy was going to meet us. I couldn't turn it down. I'm infantry. I know how to escape and evade, and that's exactly what I did. And I made it back on, and sure enough, I got caught. You know, they took away my 3-day pass. They gave me an Article 15. We had this nice thing planned. I was going to go skiing. You know, New Zealand is like California. You can ski up in the mountains and be down on the beach, swimming and surfing the same day. It's that nice. It was the most beautiful country. I got them back, though. Apparently, I drank. We broke into the company beer tent while they were gone, and I learned how to play this drinking game called Cardinal Puff, and I urinated on myself, falling backwards, and kept urinating. And then I threw up on all the duffel bags. So if anybody here was in my unit and you got puke on your duffel bag, I sincerely apologize. I'll make amends to you afterwards. But that's exactly what I did. Korea, we went to Korea, and basically the same thing happened again. I had heard stories from my company about Korea because they had this thing called soju. Now, soju's Korean moonshine. It has that much formaldehyde in the top of the bottle when you shake it up. Now, what's unique about that stuff is the stories that they tell us is that you literally stay drunk for 2 or 3 days off of drinking one time. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when I heard that, I was already there. And, you know, you might not be able to make it back to the post by 11 o'clock, and you do have to make it back by 11 o'clock. You are not allowed to stay overnight. And me and Corporal Black, same guy I got in trouble with in New Zealand, we came back 2 o'clock in the morning, sure enough. Another Article 15. 1983, the military asked me to leave. It was a mutually agreeable situation. You know, Hawaii got boring. You know, I thought it would be different. And I came home, and I applied to Delaware State Police. I got accepted. And then my best friend, Charlie, my buddy, my sponsor, you know, sponsor somebody you follow directions to, he asked me a question. He goes, "How are you going to arrest people for what you like to do?" Everyone knows state police. You know, they accepted me. All I had to do was take their stupid little test, and the physical test would have been nothing. I applied in 1985. I applied to the Air National Guard to finish the last of my commitment. They put me in working on helicopters. I'm in the infantry. I had no clue what I was going to do. But I did what they said to do. I took a flight aptitude test. I passed it, barely. They offered me a position to go fly helicopters down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, to go to warrant officer school, learn how to fly helicopters. And within a few months after that, I was on my way to federal prison for 7 years as a direct result of my alcoholism. You know, how do you get to that? Well, I'm only alcoholic, but other things, secondary infections are in my story, and some of those things cost a lot of money. So you have to become self-employed, and that's what I did. And I got caught up in a ring, and, you know, it made half the newspaper in my local newspaper. You know, and like I said, Saturday, and I always make the news, but it's never for anything good, even sober. You know, and that's just my experience. And you know, I went to prison. You know, I remember when the judge brought the gavel down, and my mom and my oldest sister's in the audience in 7 years, and I go back to my cell, and I was only supposed to get 2 years of probation. And the prosecutor even came back and apologized. I don't know what that was all about, but I'm bawling my eyes out. And I couldn't even imagine. I'm only thinking about me. Can you imagine my poor mother? Here's her son. You know, he's an honorable discharge vet. You know, he's got his high school diploma and all these things. And how'd he end up in prison? You know, all for the price of a drink. All for the price of a drink and everything that goes along with my drinking. That I am powerless over stopping once I get started. Same thing happened in prison. You know, I get let out on a 32-hour furlough, and I end up getting drunk, and Charlie's there again, my only visit, and he brings my mom, and we debated while drinking how much of that leafy green stuff I could smoke and give a clean urine the next day. That keen alcoholic thinking, and we're debating it. 4 hits sounded reasonable, and I'm here today, and no, it's not, because 2 weeks later, I'm I'm in my little dollar, you know, in prison you make like a couple cents, but I had a job at the furniture factory, which is Unicorn, and I was making like almost a buck, so that's real big money in that. And here they come, I'm off, you know, and I'm like, you know, I was in a co-ed, men and women, no fence, minimum security prison camp, and now I'm off to a medium maximum security penitentiary in upstate New York. We go through Lewisburg, and they got bullet holes in the wall, and I'm like, what did I do? See, I can't even see it. It's the booze, you know. I can't see it, you know. I don't know. I get out. I'm let out. I get out on my first overnight pass at the halfway house. I want to be with her. I haven't been with her for a long time, you know. And somebody handed me a drink, and I don't make it back for the curfew call. And they come and get me at 2 o'clock in the morning. Here I am. I'm going back to prison as a direct result of drinking, and I can't see it. I get out on parole, and what I hear the PO say is, hey, is, you know, kid, you got a problem with drugs, but it's okay to drink. You know, they call that delusional in AA. That guy didn't say that, but that's what I heard, you know. So what do? I start drinking on the weekend, and it progresses into every day. I'm trying not to do the other things and just drink, but in my thing, you know, when I'm drunk, I have that filter mechanism up there that's non-existent in the non-alcoholic that says it's okay to do everything under the sun to change how I feel. You're drunk and you're spinning. Well, there's chemicals you can do that takes that away, you know. And I developed a little crack problem, you know. And I'm off to the races. And that stuff has a mind of its own. Make a long story short, I started getting DTs when I would try to stop. And it scared the hell out of me. And the solution for that is not to quit drinking, but to make sure you always have booze. You know, and you ever, you know, in Delaware when I was living, you know, I'm living at my mom's house, and in Delaware back then they didn't have the liquor stores open on Sunday. So you buy enough booze on Saturday to see you through on Sunday. But that phenomenon of craving sometimes doesn't shut off, and I'm not allowed to participate in the decision-making process in that. And so sometimes I might drink everything Saturday night, and I can't pass out or black out or whatever out until everything's gone in the fridge. And what that presents is an opportunity to, if you don't have a license, to walk 20 miles to a liquor store in Maryland, or you're begging people to take you. And if you're shaking, walking might not be an option. And I remember begging my mom one Sunday morning to take me, and I was in tears, man, because it hurt. And she wouldn't take me. And I'm begging her, and she wouldn't take me. And then finally she relenting, because I'm in tears. And my solution to that problem was not to stop drinking. That never entered the thing. It was, I got to get my license back, because I'll never be humiliated like that again. So I'm back to the drinking and driving programs that I've already failed numerous times, because they have that stupid requirement that you got to go to AA. I don't know about any of you, but back then I knew what an alcoholic was. I watched Coretta, and I watched Barney Miller, and I watched what alcoholics were on TV. Hollywood educated me, and that's not me. Sure, I might drink out of a paper bag every once in a while, and brandy on a winter day when we're working. I do construction, you know, but that's a, you know, but that's not me. And the guy told me that we're getting ready to graduate this program, and he told me that if you don't go to AA these last 2 weeks, you will not graduate. But he goes, I'll make you a deal. If you go to AA twice a week the last 2 weeks of this program, I'll give your license back. And so I got welcomed into and introduced into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to AA one time before. It was in the 1970s with a friend of mine who definitely needed it back then. You know, we showed up drunk and high. And there was a bunch of old people. They were in their 30s and 40s, you know. And at 17, that looks old, you know. And I didn't hear anything, but I went. Out of that invitation, I stayed sober from 1992 to 1995. I had a temporary sponsor. You know, in our crowd, what we say about temporary sponsorship, you want temporary sponsorship, you might want temporary sobriety. It's not my experience to this day what temporary sponsorship is. I just don't know what that is. I did my own version of a four-step, I wrote a biography. I actually read it to my temporary sponsor. And I remember walking out of that experience with it felt like a weight had lifted off of me. But because I did not follow the exact directions that's prescribed to recover from alcoholism, I would eventually drink again. And that happened in 1995. To this day, I don't know why in 1995, at 2.5 years sober, I started drinking again. I had a brand new house. I had 2 vehicles in the driveway. I had taken a hostage, a wife. She had started having children. I forced her to marry me, you know, and I remember her mother walking up to me prior to the marriage, because they paid a lot of money. We got married in that little chapel down there. Didn't have the thing, and her mother coming up to me and says, "You ever hurt my daughter, I'm going to kill you." Little would she know, that's guaranteed what happened on her watch, because I'm an alcoholic. I played God with everything and everybody. That's why the book says if you take the drink and set it aside, that's not our problem. We have a physical allergy to alcohol. Should be able to walk away from it. I'm allergic to shellfish. I've ate crabs twice after I found out. When I was flopping on the grounds, I never touched crabs again. When it came to booze, and it did way worse than flopping on the ground, I didn't have that same mentality. It just wasn't in my cards or whatever. You know, it got bad at the end of 1995, and I came running back because I put together a gang to rob banks. Because unlicensed pharmaceuticals showed up on the horizon. And I found people that thought just like me. Being I'm an ex-con from the federal system, I did a lot of time with bank robbers, and I figured I could get away with what they couldn't. You know, I didn't waste my time in that facility. You know, I educated. You know, to make a long story short, I had an incident that scared me. I came running back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the next time I stayed for 4.5 years. I got a sponsor. I actually had 3 sponsors. Who were recovered alcoholics, who tried to pass this solution on me, but I balked. I heard an AA, take what you want and leave the rest. That is not in the big book, folks. And my great-grandsponsor down in Baltimore told a group of us, that's still selfish and self-centered. But I didn't see it, you know. There's a lot of stuff in the fellowship that does not line up with our big book. And we as a society are supposed to agree upon that big book as a way to recover from alcoholism. It's not wishy-washy, eh? This is the steps you take. If you follow these directions, this is the guaranteed results you will get for permanent sobriety. Not if, when, this, that. Permanent sobriety. You can stay sober for the rest of your life. Our founders found it. The Washingtonians knew that and had it back in the 1800s, but they lost it because they didn't have the traditions. Because their speakers got into speaking for money, and they got into the abolition movement, the slavery movement. Abraham Lincoln spoke at one of their events. They were a million strong at 10 years. By year 11, they were gone, dead. Some of those people probably stayed sober because they kept one alcoholic working with another. The same principle that will save my butt every single time if I'm willing to take that action. June of 2001, I came running back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed and wanted AA, and needing and wanting AA is not enough in my experience. I can't help it if it's not yours. I did the math at beginner's meetings at a beginner's table. I said, here the first time, 2.5 years. Second time, 4.5 years. This time I'll be here the rest of my life for at least 10 years. Within 2 days, I'm pounding my fist on a bar down in Chestertown, Maryland, had no money, and my coworker said all they would buy me was a freaking soda. But when I stood in front of the bartender, you know what came out of my mouth? Epic, give me a Budweiser. And then once that one beer was down, you're buying, ain't you? Bring on the tequila. Probably did crack that night, too. And my kids probably went hungry that week. My wife's disabled. Wasn't working. Her accident for getting rear-ended didn't settle at that time. No Social Security. I was the only source of income. But yet when it came down to paying my mortgage or feeding my kids or drinking, I could have every intention to think the drink through, and thinking the drink through does not work if you're an alcoholic. It didn't work for me because when that thought occurs, which is the mental obsession, you can't outthink it. Sound familiar? That's in our book. Yet you'll hear some bozo from the podium or from the audience, think the drink through. Try doing that if you're a real alcoholic. How do you outthink in mental obsession? Because it crowds out all normal thoughts out of the mind, pushes them out. And next thing I know, I'm off to the races, and some of you are shaking your head because you know what I'm speaking is from the heart, and it's true if you're a real alcoholic. If you're not, good deal. But I am, and that's my experience. I remember out there on my last run, I remember, you know, here comes three people from AA, and I'm waiting a cop for my man. What did I do? Duck down! Oh my God, the AA guys are there, you know? Can you imagine that? Why can't a cop be right there? It got so bad. I remember, you know, the bathroom was my favorite place to get done at that time, and they're always out there, you know. I remember scoping out the windows and stuff, and you can see people. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're checking your neighbor's car and shit. There might be some unmanageability to that, you know. All that changed July 21st of 2001 when I had an epiphany. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to go to rehab. I got insurance. They got to take me. So I called up a rehab. I picked a place that has a chef. It's on the ward. Call them up, 8 o'clock in the morning. My plan. Got to work. Get them on the phone. They take my insurance information. Come back, Mr. Phillips, you got a problem. You can't come here. What do I got to do to come? Go to outpatient therapy and fail. Oh, God. I'm already failing, brother. I've been up for 24 hours on a crack binge from hell. Gave my first resentment. And then he said something that still to this day, I remember those words ringing. He goes, you got money. Like I said at the Pottstown meeting Saturday, it's not like I could have called up my crack dealer. I know I built an addition on his massive wing, his palace, for a loan. You know, because that place was like $20,000 or $30,000 to go away for a month. You know, AA stepped in right then and there. God stepped in and gave me a moment of clarity. It was like watching a made-for-TV movie, and I can still to this day remember it when I hung up that phone and that whole scene of a guy coming up to me in a June meeting says, my name's Dickie, here's a phone list, my number's on it, if you ever want help, please, please call me. And that whole scene of him doing that in that June meeting portrayed in my mind right then and there. Can't tell me there's not a God, because I definitely was not in my right mind. And I came running back to AA. AA wasn't going to be like it. You know, I used to sit in meetings and just being in around you people would give me relief. And it wasn't going to be my experience this time. Because alcoholism is progressive. You do damage to your body when from the drinking and everything else that goes along with it. And I got worse as the days went on. And I won't go into what they told me that's not in the big book. But every suggestion that I was given did not work. And I guess it wasn't meant to work. I was meant to find people that do exactly what's outlined in the big book. Recovered alcoholics who aren't embarrassed to say that they're recovered alcoholics. You know, that's another thing that I've noticed. I'm almost 8 years sober, and when I tell somebody I'm a recovered alcoholic, when you have part of the audience look at you like they're growing a head out of the neck, there might be a problem with our fellowship agreeing upon the same simple, clear-cut directions of solution that we're supposed to have, because the big book says recovered numerous times. Doesn't mean we're cocky. It doesn't mean whatever you think it means. It means exactly what I've been restored to a sanity. You know? I don't know. I don't want to bitch about the fellowship. You know, it is what it is. Anyway, make a long story short, I was in a meeting in downtown Baltimore and I was given a sponsor. I did not pick mine. Thank God for that. Imagine me picking somebody I could identify with. I'm homicidal and suicidal. Let's go find some other nutbag to go with. Thank God that was not my experience. The guy he gave me was only sober 6 months, but he had been through all 12 steps, and he was already taking other people through the work, and he agreed to take me through the work outlined in the big book to the best of his human ability, and he did. He asked me if I knew where the doctor's opinion was, and I read that big book for years. Hell, I knew about the history of the Washingtonians the last time I was sober for 4.5 years. And I didn't know he was talking about Dr. Silkworth's letters One addressed to people who might meet people like me, recovered alcoholics. The next one was addressed to all of us in the fellowship. I thought he was talking about Dr. Powell's story. Who the hell reads the Roman numeral section of a book? I've been to college. You don't read that. That's what? You read the, where the chapters are, but what's in the Roman numeral section of a book? Well, he explained to me, and I met the guy the next day, and we went through the first four steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a freaking miracle. He told me things that nobody in AA had ever said to me before, or I was not listening. We identified whether I was alcoholic or not. Guess what? If you're a sponsor, you're supposed to do that according to working with others. It says it right in, working with others. If you're satisfied, they're alcoholic. Why is that? So there's a common identification purpose between you two, so that you have a common problem, then maybe that person, if they can see that you have the same problem that they have, that maybe the solution that you're using to stay sober and recover from your alcoholism might work for them too. And that's what I think. That is my opinion. But that's why I think they put that statement in there. But he made sure I was an alcoholic. Didn't take long. Didn't take hard. A blind man could have seen the wreckage I left. Yeah. There's when you start drinking, can you predict with any certainty when you're going to stop? Yes or no? Our crowd is really big in yes or no. If you ask an alcoholic what time it is, they will tell you how that clock on the wall is built to the fine precision instruments inside of it. An hour later, they haven't told you what time it is. Our crowd doesn't have time for that, so they ask yes or no questions. So when he asked me that, no. Once I start, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And they ask me, you ever stopped before on purpose? Yeah, George, I stopped before. He goes, from a point of being stopped, do you know when you're going to start again with any certainty? I stop folks more times than I can count than there's toes and fingers in this room. On purpose, I quit. I give up. Only to find myself again and again and again back to the bottle, back to the only solution that I know that takes and shuts this up. They have that thing called restlessness in the big book. It's where your mind goes a million miles an hour. There's a committee going on up there, and you're not allowed to participate. Can't get a word in edgewise, let alone anybody else. So, yeah, I'm alcoholic. Perilous. Guess what? To this day, I'm no longer perilous because of the fact that I've done the solution and I live this because my life depends on it. You ever notice in step one it says we admitted we were perilous? They weren't stupid when they wrote that. They were talking from a recovered state that they are no longer perilous. Get the Al-Anon crap out of here, because they might have to be perilous over people, place, and things. How can you still be perilous if lack of power is your dilemma? How can you still be perilous if you've done the steps, had the awakening, and tapped into the power, even over people, places, and things? It says right in our book, my will is out of line with God's. Well, if I'm lining my will with God's, why would I need power over anybody else, including myself? God will provide every power that I ever need to get through anything. So I'm not powerless over people, places, and things. I don't need the power. That's the solution in our steps. Many people miss that. I guess we should not combine other fellowships into AA. There might be a reason for that. I don't know. My sponsor took me through step two, and we whisked right through it, you know. It says in our book, do you now believe or are you willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? And how he explained that to me, he started explaining principles, and did I know what a principle was? And no, you know. He says, we have these things called physical principles. They affect everybody whether you believe in them or not. And he said something to the effect about gravity and us walking off of a building, and if I didn't have a belief in gravity, what would happen to me? Well, I don't know. I guess I'd fall. Yeah, but if you don't believe in it, would it still affect you? Yeah. Right then and there, I had an epiphany. I had a shift. My paradigm shifted. Paradigm is a box, a way to, a certain rules to do things. And the mirror, and I was an experiential educator for a few years. The people that are some of the most intelligent people in the world, they have the ability to shift the paradigm. And that's when stuff in our society changes. It's like when the computer comes through. And all of a sudden, now everybody's got a computer. That started from a couple guys putting a box of lights together. They had the visionary to shift the paradigm of how things go together instead of these big boxes to make it. It was a paradigm shift. My sponsor did that for me. And then he said something that nobody in AA had ever asked me before. He goes, David, do you believe that I believe that there's this power who I chose to call God that's kept me sober for 6 months? And when I looked in George's eyes, I knew he believed. He goes, if you can believe that I believe, then that's enough to go on with the rest of the steps. We then said the third step prayer together. Powerful stuff. I left with the directions to start my fourth step. Unfortunately, George's experience, he missed some of the stuff in the fourth step as far as the three prayers that are in the fourth step and the new sex ideal that's on page 69. Stuff that is vitally important, folks, vitally important. Because let me ask anybody a question. Is it important that we do all the directions, or is it okay to leave certain stuff out of the directions? Being that person's life is on the line to avert misery and death, and this disease, I've been to enough funerals now to know this time sober that this thing kills people. And they're not the ones that suffer anymore. It's like when we went to Timmy's funeral and watching Timmy's nephews ripping the coffin, saying, "Oh God, Uncle Timmy, why?" Seeing the wife, I've seen that enough. So this is a life and death proposal. And I'm not trying to preach, but is it important? Do you think it's important that maybe we shouldn't miss any of the directions? There's three prayers in a fourth step. I didn't know that for over 2 years. There's a new sex ideal that you're supposed to come out of so you don't continue to place God in that part of your life. Oh, can't talk about an alcoholic sex life. They got to have something to, you know. Bullshit. You work for God. Step three, you fire you. You hire God. You're not in charge of your life anymore. Like my great-grandfather down in Baltimore, he says, if you're an alcoholic, you go past a graveyard, you feel like a no-show. I know what that feels like. I belong dead. I did everything in my power to kill me. 2000, I was begging God at 3 o'clock in the morning to kill me. Not because my life was grand. Because that was a solution that the only thing I knew that would stop me. I got 4 kids, a handicapped wife, they love me. It's not enough. I want to die. I did the best I could with what the directions I was given. My wife, at 2 years sober, chose to leave me, and it was not pleasant how she left. And some of you know how she left. I had to speak in Harbor City speaker meeting, and 2 weeks after that, in front of about 200 people in the old building. You know, I caught her in bed with one of my sponsees. How the hell do you stay sober through that? What are people in AA going to think of me? My solution was never to sponsor anybody ever again. That's what, you can't do that. You can do that. May want to make you blow your brains out, or the booze may become a solution again. 6 months later, I went back through the steps with my now sponsor. You know, and I gained the freedom out of that experience that I've yet to rival in AA, in my experiences of AA. My sponsor turned and looked at me, and when he gave me the exact directions for the sex list, and I brought him that list, he looked at me and said, "You've been raping your wife." See, you know, it was my wife, my kids, my house, my truck. My. It's not mine. Those are things given to me by God, who I agreed to work for, to better do whose will. Not David's will, but God's will. I walked out of that experience with no ability from that point on to judge my wife and the actions she chose how to lead, nor my sponsees. The freedom that I got from that is indescribable. I no longer needed them to make up who I am. I was finally free for the first time in my life. Prior to that, I was stalking my wife with one of my sponsees. He's 2 weeks sober, and he's like, "Dave, you have a core. What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Shut up, what do you know? You're sober 2 weeks, you know? Mr. Sponsor, you know, Jesus." I left my wife and kids alone. I walked away from that relationship free. I went and made amends to my wife, and, you know, whatever you want me to do to make this right between us, I'm willing to do. I showed up when I was asked to show up. We reunited because I became a different person. Like I spoke earlier, I picked up a skydiving fetish in 2001. We were down in Florida, 6 months sober, and my wife's lawsuit had settled, and I did this thing called indoor skydiving, and I got invited out to do some tandem jumping the next day, and I'm scared to death of heights, but I went ahead because I like a rush. Can you tell? And I remember going out of that plane, man. I kept my eyes closed, but it was so exciting when I opened my eyes up. We got offered to do it again at a reduced price of what we originally paid, and we went right back up. And, you know, here it is, folks. If you're alcoholic, because I'm alcoholic, and you like something, you might obsess about it. And I did. I wanted to be one of the best skydivers on the East Coast, and I set out. That's what I was going to do. I wanted to teach skydiving, and I got a chance to do that. I was a free fly instructor over in New Jersey, teaching people how to sit fly. It's not normal skydiving. At points in time, like anything else, it becomes boring after a while, and you do things to change it. So I learned how to base jump, and we were down in West Virginia jumping off that bridge. Base jumping is highly illegal, but the rush was worth it. At least that's what we tell ourselves when we're doing it, you know. Anyway, I started learning how to do high-performance landings on canopies, which you come down 90 miles an hour and swoop your canopy about that high off the ground. You got to know what you're doing. If you make any mistakes, you're going to be crippled, lose a limb, or die. August 1st, 2 weeks after my fourth anniversary, we're on the way to the drop zone, and we blew a stop sign. I wasn't driving, and the cop found out where we were going. He goes, "You guys are doing something dangerous enough. I'll let you go." Little did I know what he was going to. He must have foreseen something. Within about an hour, I had impacted the ground so hard, my computer and my helmet said I hit the ground over 40 miles an hour, shattering my pelvis, my sacrum, both my legs, and broke both my feet and punctured my femoral artery. And I lay dying on the ground. They airlifted me out, and I spent the next 2 weeks in a drug-induced coma. I came to paralyzed from the waist down. And I belong dead. You know what AA did for me? You know, I ain't never been worth anything, even in AA. But you know what AA cared enough? You people that loved me called one out, and they brought me meetings. Guys from the last stop, man, I love the last stop guys, came to see me. I cried at that first meeting they brought me because I knew I belonged dead. My own home group members, some are sitting here, bought me meetings to my house. More important than that, they bought me people to take through the steps. That's important because it took the attention off of how bad my body was broken up. You know, and I'm like, how am I going to help these people? They said, shut up and just take them through the steps. And I did. You know, my life changed. You know, I made the news for that too. Just like I said, I don't have a good track record making the news. If you see David Phelps in the news, it's a bad thing. It's never good. You know, at least that's my experience. I started doing a lot of AA online. I couldn't go to meetings for a long time, and when I did go, I had to go in a wheelchair and then into a walker, and I had to relearn how to walk. I met thousands of people all across the world, and I had opportunities to take people through the steps, men and women. It's not my experience. I've sponsored quite a few women. You know, oh, that's not supposed to do that. Show me in the big book where it says we're not supposed to do that. Sponsorship is gender neutral. I just took a lady today from the United Kingdom. We have voice now on our computer where I can use Yahoo Messenger. She's in the UK. That's in London, England, I guess. And we're going through. There is a solution. We almost got all the way through the chapter. And I'm giving her the history of Roland Hazard, how he ended up getting turned away from Dr. Young because Dr. Young did not have a solution for him. He spent an entire year with him, and we're going through that, you know. And when we're discussing the things about whether she's alcoholic or not, because that's the identification process more over and over and over again, she's saying, that's me, that's me, that's me. You know, what a gift, what a gift. I'm taking hundreds of people through the steps. Doesn't make me special. That doesn't make me Mr. AA. It just means that God has given me opportunity, experience He doesn't give everybody. But what a gift! What a gift! I got involved with this thing called Steel on Steel, which is like doing a fifth step every 2 weeks. Series of about 20 questions that are more in-depth on the same spiritual principles that we live in AA than anything that AA has ever done. And a group of four of us did it. One of the guys is sitting right here in the room with me. We did it for about a year, I believe it was. Right, EJ? About a year. Questions like, are you a good steward of God's money? Have you made all your amends? That's not for beginning sobriety. You have to even to do that. Mark Houston and Dave Fredrickson were the ones that came up with that. They got it from the Book of Proverbs. As iron sharpens iron, so must one man's character sharpen another man's character. I became spiritually accountable to those men in that group. And I grew exponentially. What a gift, man. You know, I'm spiritually accountable to this day to my sponsor. Spiritually accountable to my sponsees. You know, I'll tell you, man, it's for somebody that belong dead, that has no right to draw a human breath, you people and God did something for me that I'll never be able to pay back. But it doesn't mean I should not try. You know, I did the Perry Point Tuesday night commitment, providing speakers for that place for about 3 years every Tuesday, and made sure that they were all recovered alcoholics that spoke at that facility, so that those men and women that were returning from Iraq who are like us and who may have other problems other than alcohol, here's a message of hope. Because I think we all of us have a responsibility when you're speaking from the podium, that you may not represent Alcoholics Anonymous, but you should have a message of hope. Who the hell wants to hear about how bad your day is? That's not attractive. But yet you go into any meeting, I've been to meetings all across America, where you hear that's the common theme. That turns more people away from Alcoholics Anonymous than anything else. Because nobody wants to hear about us whine how bad our life is. Life is bad for everybody. But are you taking, the big book says we're supposed to take those opportunities to show that we work for God as demonstrations of how powerful His will is. If these guys that I came with after the meeting, that sat with me meeting after meeting, did they talk? Did they hear me whine one time when I couldn't walk? I was on narcotics. I can't even spell. I remember whining to my sponsor, how am I going to get through this without being an addict? I was a junkie since I was 15 years old. How am I going to get through that? He said, David, you follow the directions of a sponsor, you follow these directions of the big book, you will get through it. Let your doctor know that you're alcoholic. That's what I did. I came off of the meds at about 2.5 months sober. I said, that's it, I'm done, because I did not like being fogged, and I was still in massive pain. But I did not like feeling fogged. By the end of that weekend, I was in so much pain, I was standing at the door crying because the pain was, I can't. And I looked up and I said, God, either you take this damn pain from me right now, or I'm going back on the meds. Now, I'm not stupid. I went right back on the meds. 2 weeks later, folks, I came off of all meds in one weekend with no addiction. And I was on high doses of oral morphine. Fentanyl before that. How is that possible? How come I'm not a junkie trying to hit up pills? And I'm still in pain to this day. My body had hardware that held it together, a movable plate and screws it. Do you ask these guys when they looked at the x-rays, it looked like Herman Munster, or better yet, Edward Scissorhands in my pelvis. My body began to reject the hardware last year. And I had to go down to the University of Maryland through the VA hospital, and they had to remove every bit of it. My pelvis never healed. I have one leg that's shorter than the other one. Instead of being bone in the pelvis and the sacrum, fibrous tissue is what the CAT scan has showed. And they warned me, David, if you ever fall, even a little bit, you'll bleed out before we can do anything for you. You're going to die. But your body's rejecting the hardware. So they had to take it out. You know? I work for God, you know, so I do know this, and I'll leave you with this. You know, my mistake in all that skydiving and base jumping, my attitude being around you good people, is the fact that I'm okay, I work for God. I won't die. I never thought about getting hurt. I crippled my family financially because of that accident. I had a fairly lucrative construction company. When that accident happened, every one of my mechanics quit. And I had a contract that was due. I had to get out there in a wheelchair and run synthetic stucco. I couldn't walk. I remember walking over to the wall. I get up out of the thing and I'm holding my wife's shoulders like this to an 8-foot plank, and I've got to do it. It's probably almost as large as this room because nobody would help. But I did it because I signed in the contract and I didn't want to default on the contract that these people were kind enough to give me. And I did it. May have caused damage. I don't know. Don't really care. That Christmas of that year was probably the best Christmas my children have ever had up to this date. They had gifts coming from God knows where. My family. We had no money. We had no money. We never went without. We had to declare bankruptcy. Never went without. All I know is I showed up, I suited up, I did what I thought God would have me do. Last February, and this is coming from bankruptcy a few years ago, last February we bought a brand new house on an acre of land, $250,000 house. How is that possible? Maybe this thing of God will give us anything we need to better do His will is real. You know? I know it's my job. Is to show up on a daily basis to better do His will. And I don't do it perfectly. You know, I'm still full of character defects. But we have a 10th step that takes care of that during the day, and it's followed by an 11-step review. For 7.5, almost 8 years, every night I've done that page 86 review of those questions. And when you combine that with the 10th step, it produces an armor that nothing can get through, that makes my will, forces my will to conform to God's will. What a gift. I was taught to do quiet meditation at 2.5 years sober. Sit quietly from anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes. I did that again this morning. I do it every morning. I don't miss a morning not doing it. Why? Because my heart needs to hear from God. It's like my sponsor says, I ask him a question, I say, I'm seeing the dog. Take a dump. How spiritual is that? He goes, maybe God isn't seeing and talking to your mind, David. Maybe He's talking to here. My mind, there's lines in the other big book that says utterances of the Spirit cannot be interpreted by the mind, nor even heard. So maybe God needs that quiet time to talk to my heart, to tell it what it needs to do that day, because I know this, the book's real specific. If you're alcoholic, you do not do that. The book says, our founder said and swore on it, and it's in our book, that you will not survive the trials and low spots ahead. Because you will go back to the only solution that ever worked to relieve that, and that's booze. Or a gun will look real good. And thank God you people gave me a solution that works through anything. I've been to Mardi Gras down on Bourbon Street sober twice. There was 1 million people, they said, on the news drunk. If I had fallen in the curb, I would have gotten drunk by osmosis. If you ever been down there, they got beads in the curb, and I was ready to fix them up. I'm like, beads? Wow! They were like, man, those are booze soaked. Stay away. The book says that if you do this, you will know a freedom and a happiness beyond your wildest dreams. You'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. And it also says that if you can't go around those conditions, there's something wrong with your spiritual condition. You need to check your motives. See what you can bring to those events. There's booze in my house now. It doesn't affect me. The obsession's been removed. The problem's been solved. You people and God, in my understanding, the 12 steps gave me a gift that I'll never be able to repay. But in my little way that I try, I take people and offer them the same solution, just like Nikki this morning. every time. I look for people to do that. That's my job as a recovered alcoholic. Look for the people that are suffering. Offer this solution. I was taught, go up to people, ask them, how long are you sober? What step are you on? You got a sponsor? The new people that don't have the solution will look like they're taking a dump. They'll have that tormented look on their face. Y'all laughing, but y'all know it's true. And then offer them this. If you've had experience being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, just like I was told, if you're not enjoying your sobriety, maybe you're doing it wrong. And if you're not able to live, more important than that, if you're not able to live comfortably in your own skin, then maybe your will is out of line with God's. And we have a solution for that. Thanks for letting me share.